Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Let's start using cutting-edge warp speed 5G technology with your cell phone. Let me tell you about my friends at mobilemobile.io. They have an ultra-fast 4G LTE and 5G network that covers 99% of Americans. So they've got you covered everywhere. Think about it for a moment. You have the opportunity to take a test drive for 10 days with unlimited talk, text, and premium data. What is premium data? Premium data is an allotment of a cellular data that you receive from a higher priority on the network. You won't get throttled like you will with some of those, well, non-brand service providers. To find out more information, all you have to do is go to mobilemobile.io. That's mobilemobile.io to start your 10-day free trial.
This show is brought to you by Safety FM.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of the Jay Allen Show. I hope everything is good and grand inside of your neck of the woods as we get to hang out on this lovely 24th of January of 2023. Yes, I'm still struggling with not saying 2022. Don't worry about that. So how are things? How are things with you? How are things going? Is everything good as you are hanging out in this new year? I hope the answer to that question has been an astounding yes, as we are taking a look around with everything that's going on. Now, a few weeks ago, I was actually hanging out in St. Petersburg, Florida at the Safety 2 Practical Application Conference, and I was able to sit down and, you know, take a listen to some of the things that was going on at the event. So with that being said, I have one today that I would love to share with you. And this one is called Why Learning from Accident Does Little to Improve Safety. Think about that. Why learning from accidents does little to improve safety. Yes, that's the name of the episode. Now, listen, this is a presentation by Eric Holnagel. He is the Senior Professor of Patient Safety. So as you sit back today and take a listen to this, pay really, really close attention to what's going on with Eric, as Eric is very well known throughout the industry. And take a listen to his words of wisdom that he has in regards of what is going on within the world of safety and just kind of within the world in general. Just take a listen, and you'll notice towards the end, there are some questions that come in from audience members. I'm going to go ahead and leave those in for this particular cut, where you can take a listen to what Eric has to say. So there you go. Let's start off right now. Here's Eric Holnagel with his little presentation coming from the Safety 2 Practical Application Conference that took place in St. Petersburg, Florida.
Before we start, there's one thing I need to say. That is, if you ever are unlucky enough to get an email from me, At the bottom it says the difference between what you can imagine and what can happen is larger than you can imagine. And that happened to me last year. I woke up one morning lying on the floor and had a stroke. I never imagined that. So I'm still suffering from that. Hence my speech is slightly incomprehensible. But at least I have a good excuse now if you don't understand me at all. And when as I prepared for this, I had the usual number of slides, but I've cut them down dramatically. I realized today it doesn't really matter because in the old days you would show a slide and you talk about it, but now you show a slide and everybody takes a picture. And so it doesn't matter if you don't understand me. It's worth it if you don't understand what you took a picture of. And don't come back and ask me about it, please. Because I'm not sure I have the answer. So this is what I'm going to talk about. Why learning from accidents doesn't help to improve safety. And see if we can get to the next one. So I think I'll start here because we talked a lot about safety. And of course, we all know that safety is the problem. But I think I wasn't here all day yesterday, but I think you were discussing also what is safety actually. So the only thing we can say is that the lack of safety is very costly. I'm just taking some statistics you can find. You know that traffic accidents is by far the most costly. 508 billion dollars. That's quite a lot of money, even in euro. I won't even mention Danish kroner, which is... I can't even do the calculation in my head. So I think, I look around for definitions of safety, and I find many different definitions, and I'm not sure whether safety is a quality or quantity. Here too, safety is a freedom from unacceptable risk. That's a quality. And safety is the activity of ensuring that accidents are avoided. And, you know, believe it or not, there's something called which has another definition. It says safety is a concept that includes all measures and practices taken to preserve the life, health, and bodily integrity of individuals. So it's about protection, it's about things not happening. So you need to ask, what is safety actually? Because there are so many definitions around. And as you know, it's now common to talk about two interpretations, which are called safety one and safety two. And safety one is that the number of things that go wrong is as small as possible, and that leads to the target zero, that is no accidents. And I think the opposite that we come up with is that safety is a condition where the numbers that go well, I won't say right, I want to say instead, is as high as possible. And I call that target quintum. Quintum is Latin for 100. So the target is 100% of everything you do should go well. And I think that's what we're interested in, because if something goes well, it can't fail at the same time. So you might as well turn it around. Instead of preventing from fail, that's why I have the coin here. You have a biased coin, so it comes up heads all the time. But that's cheating. That's what you want to do. You want to cheat so you get hits all the time in your work, of course. So I think this brings me, one way of phrasing it is, the question is not to be or not to be, is to do or not to do. Should we focus on what we should do or on what we shouldn't do? And I think classical safety, we focus on what we shouldn't do. And we tell people, don't do this, don't do that. Here's another procedure and tell you what you shouldn't do. But I think it's more important, and it's much easier to tell people what they should do, and they like it more. Nobody likes to be told, don't do that. if you want to design a work environment, it's more important to tell them what to do and not, than to tell them what not to do. So that's why I've taken the liberty of distorting Shakespeare a little bit here and say, I think it should be to do or not to do. I won't do the whole soliloquy. I'm sure you'll be happy about that. So 51, which I also call protective safety, it's about protection. And the metaphor is a glass that's filled with things that go wrong, and you want to have it empty. That's a zero vision. So you look at what's in the glass and you try to understand it, and you try to find ways of removing it. That's a classical way of doing safety. Of course, you can have the opposite, where you say you still use the analogy with the glass, but you want to have it full now of things that go well. So that's what I call productive safety, because if things go well, you make money also, and you produce. So it's a win-win situation. If things go well, you don't have any accidents, but you also produce and you create revenue. And that's what safety too is about. So try to think of these jars and whether you want to empty your jar, you want to fill it. Another way of looking at it is, and I'm grateful for Marie de Vos, a doctor in the Netherlands who came up with this wonderful analogy. We try to improve safety by looking at situations where something went wrong. And if something goes wrong, you say almost always say there was a lack of safety. So how can you study safety in situations where you say there was a lack of safety? You can't study anything if it isn't there. And I like her analogy. Can you understand what a happy marriage is by analyzing divorces alone? Of course you can't. You can say when you're married, you want to try to avoid a divorce, but that's not good enough, I think. I speak out of experience. I've had one divorce. And that wasn't good enough. So, but I hope I'll never have another one. So Tom said it was to come up with some practical advice for how to do it. So I thought, I'm an academic really, so I don't know how to do things. And I know we're not allowed to say philosophy here. I am. Okay, thank you. So this is nothing to do with philosophy. I'm sure you know this one, Stop, Think, Act. And to me, I call this is a stop, think, act. For the safety bond version, it's aimed at the sharp end, the people who work there, who do the work. When something happens, you say, stop, think, and then act. I think what we need is, we need another version, which is for the blunt end, the safety two version. And that's what you should do when you have an incident or an accident, some irreportable event. You should say, stop, and say, are you looking for causes, the efficiency, just to find the cause and close the case? Or are you really trying to understand what went on? That's what I call thoroughness. And then think, do you want to limit or constrain work as imagined, or do you want to facilitate and support work as done? And act, I think you should engage with people at this moment because they know what's going on and get them involved in implementing the changes that you together agree are the right things to do to make sure that work will go well in the future. So that's my suggestion for how to do it practically. Think about these, stop, think, act, and in interpretation. So I have a few more slides actually. You want me to go on now?
Yes.
Okay. So this is just repeating what I've said about safety one and safety two. So safety one is what I call protective safety. And you can see the premise is that we need to understand why accidents happen. And we define safety by its absence. I think Jimmy Rushin wrote that in a paper some years ago, but nobody pays attention to that. What they think about when you say Jimmy Rushin is Swiss cheese, and they never read any of his other stuff, which is quite good. And that's a pity. He also says safety is defined more by its absence than by its presence. And he's absolutely right. So safety is like this. If something bad happens, you want to get away from it. And the problem with that is, I'm a psychologist, you know, that if you want to get away from something, whichever direction you take will work because it'll take you away from the bad thing. And that's why you need to think when something happens, it actually matters what you do. It's not just avoiding something and getting rid of it, getting away from it. So when you look at the way we normally manage safety, I think you can say you manage safety by snapshots. The snapshots are the situations where something goes wrong. And they happen rarely, and they're snapshots of a system not working. And what you want to do, actually, I should have a pointer now. I use this built-in pointer. It doesn't work here on the screen, but you can see there's a sort of a little text above that says, presence of safety. So I think what you need to understand what happens up there, that's what we want to do, that's what we build, that's what we want to support. And to do that, it's not enough to look at the absence of safety. You need to look at what happens up there and understand what on earth happens up there if you want to do something about it. So what happens when you look at accidents? I've got glasses on. Many of us have got glasses on. We have got different glasses on. I haven't got a label on mine, but you can see the people have glasses with labels on, human error labels, safety culture glasses, maintenance, technical malfunction, latent conditions, root causes, whatever. And I think this was mentioned by Todd also. I think you all know this, that we have this from Heinrich, of course. He said, that's why we look at accidents and learning from accidents. We need to have knowledge of the cause and to eliminate the cause. But I think one thing we should keep in mind is that when Heinrich said that was in 1931, and what was work like in 1931 compared to the work conditions we have today, I don't think they compare at all. So using this philosophy from 1931 doesn't actually help us, because every method and every philosophy and every model is developed to meet the problems of its time. And we should use methods and models that meet the problems of our time and not the problems of 1931, even though we've gotten used to it. And that's what they still teach. So I think it's worth keeping that in mind. So that's how we think. This is, I know you have Rube Goldberg here, and he does something similar. This is a Danish cartoonist who did that. And I like that because it shows how you can think in terms of causes and effects. This is a lazy guy. This is in the old days before you had electricity and remote control of the light bulb. So he wanted to be able to switch off the light when he was going to sleep. So he invented this, and you can sort of reason through it from where he put his finger to, and you can reason what's going to happen. And you can also reason backwards. If the light suddenly goes out, you can understand why, what could go wrong on the way. And that's a nice, easy way of thinking, but the world is not like that anymore. Now he's got a remote control, and it can fail in many different ways. And it may also work and not work. If you had a wife, you could, you know, yell at her and say, go up and put out the light. But not this guy. He's got a dog instead. But the dog is not smart enough to do that, I guess. So I think we have this, what I call linear thinking, is so ingrained. We have it in absolutely everything around us. In medicine, you talk about the viruses, the germs, you make a diagnosis. We have it in physics and chemistry. We try to think in linear terms of what happens. This happened, something happened before that. And you have it in genetics, you have it in geology. We try to understand why do we have earthquakes and volcanoes. And the interesting thing, if you ever look at that, is that every time you have a big earthquake, they come up and say, we don't understand how this happened, so we have to revise our theories. I think it's the same with volcanoes, actually. They don't really know. You have it in criminal investigations. You try to find out who did what and why. I mean, that's why Sherlock Holmes is so great in detective thinking. So when things go wrong, we immediately say, what was the reason for that? What was the cause? And one of the popular ones is human failure or technical failure. If you can't figure out what the hell it is, you say it's an act of God. An act of nature, I think, depending on who you are and what you talk about. So I saw that some years ago there was a bridge, a motorway bridge that collapsed in Pakistan. And I have a newspaper clip from it. And the guys who built it said that we never had something like that happened before, so it must be an act of God. I don't know if the authorities bought that. I hope not. So the reasoning for safety one is like this, that when something happens, it's because we know that all components, will hardware or software, will fail sooner or later. Humans make errors, and they always will. There will always be unexpected and unrecognized situations, and combinations can hide sneak faults and other flaws. And conversely, when things go well, it's because systems are well designed and perfectly maintained, and people behave as expected or and as instructed as we tell them to. So work is done is the same as work is imagined. And procedures are complete and correct. I'm sure you agree with that. Designers can anticipate and prepare for every contingency. That's why we don't have accidents. And that's a way to make sure we don't have accidents. So how do we explain failures? We look, I'm sorry to apologize for the scream here. You know, there was a British TV comic years ago that said, had this picture, and he said, the title of that is, Where Are My Earrings? I'm not sure Monk would have liked that. So we look for failures, and we have sort of a standard repertoire of courses that we apply. And again, coming back to the glasses, we have different glasses on. And one important concept is what you look for is what you find. Because you have something in mind and you look for it. And then maybe you find it. It's not because it's actually what was there, it's because you looked for it. If you look for human error, you're bound to find it because there are always people in the system and they always do things that are different from what you would like them to do because they are creative and adaptive and flexible and you try to make things work. So what we do is we like what I call simple explanations and I call them monolithic explanations using the idea of a monolith from Kubrick's 2001. You remember that? So we like monolithic explanations, you know, simple explanations that are one whole that you can't break down into anything. And we like monolithic solutions also to go with the monolithic explanations because that's nice and easy. That's a one-to-one correspondence. to just for fun, I tried to make up a timeline of these explanations we have. Human factors started in about 1948, complexity in 1984 with Charles Perrault's book, and human error, human reliability after TMI in 1979, safety culture after Chernobyl and Challenger in 1986. That safety culture is surely a monolithic explanation. You say safety culture, that's it. Situation awareness in 1989. And more recently, I saw somebody suggested organizational blindness. I'm not sure what that is. But that's another, if you only overcome that, that's the main reason why things go wrong. But I also think we use them in stereotype ways. We use them either as a factual cause, that's what was there, and that's why it went wrong, or as a counterfactual cause. We say, we think it was there, and if it hadn't been there, then it would have been fine. And we also use it as a hypothetical solution. You say, we need more of that. We need more safety culture. We need more situation awareness. Or whatever it is, then we need more resilience. I should say that because we've been working on resilience engineering for some years too. And sometimes people say you need more, and that's what we feared when we started. That people would interpret it in that way. Say we just need more resilience. Could you pour some resilience into the organization, please? Or can you? I mean, I saw. Some years ago, they were trying to design cockpits that increased situation awareness. I'm not sure how that would work. And the problem is with all of these nice concepts, there's no theory behind them. They just sound extremely plausible, and people buy them. But there's also what I call, Eric Fromm was a US, very famous US psychoanalyst. And I think he said something that's very, very appropriate to this. The quest for certainty blocks the search for meaning. But another guy who wasn't a psychoanalyst, but a great philosopher, Nietzsche, said something much longer because he was a philosopher. So he couldn't make it short. So you can see here, and I won't read it. He says, the first principle is any explanation is better than none. And I think that's quite true. The cause-creating drive is just conditioned and excited by the feeling of fear. And conversely, we can avoid that if we look at safety too and say we're not interested in failures and why failures happen. We're interested in things going well, and therefore we should be interested in why things go well. And the nice thing of that is that if you, unlike failures, if you have a failure and you want to get away from a bad situation, any direction is good. If you want to get to a good situation, there's only one way to go, but you need to find it. So it's not avoidance, it's approach we should be considering. And when you manage safety, we shouldn't manage it by its absence, but by its presence. We should look at what happens about the axis, the presence of safety. What characterizes the presence of safety? And so here's the logic of safety too. You see, when nothing happens, it's because when things go well, it's because humans find ways to overcome design flaws and hindrances. It's because performance, they adjust their performance to meet the demands and the conditions. It's because procedures are used in the context of a situation. And it's because they intervene when things look like they may go wrong. And if you then look at why do we have accidents, for the very same reasons. And we need to understand that. We need to look at that better. But the truth is, if you look around it every day, most of what we do goes well from morning to night. And if you go to the supermarket here and you look for something, it's there on the shelf. And if it's not, you say, why the hell wasn't it there? What are they thinking of? But if it's there, you never say, why is it there? Which you think you should, because it's a small miracle, actually. And usually it's there, and usually things go well, and you should, the funny thing is we never stop, and I wouldn't say worry about it, we never stop and consider why things work. We always consider why they don't work, because that's unexpected. We just expect it to work, but in some sense, it's just as unexpected when things work as when they don't work, if you look at it in the right way. So why do things then go well? And we have some, sorry to say that, we have some theory about that. It comes from resilience engineering. You say things go well because we are able to respond in a flexible way to what happens. We are able to learn both from what works and from what doesn't work. We are able to monitor what goes on. And there was this question in a panel debate yesterday, I don't remember who asked that, about monitoring measurement. And so afterwards I thought of another example, say when, I think it was a lady who asked the question, and say, I always want to say to her, you cook a meal, do you monitor or do you measure? I don't think you measure very much. You monitor. You simply know, you stir in the pot and you sort of have the feeling this is right, but there's no measurement of force and torque that tells you, no, I need to put a little more of that into it. So we monitor all the time, and we do it very well. And the last thing is we are able to anticipate to look ahead, to see what's coming. And I think that's why things go well, because we're able to do these four things, which we call the systemic potentials. And that's what you should nourish and build and support in an organization, because then you will also be safe and you'll be very productive at the same time. I think that's good. So remember that, respond, monitor, learn, and anticipate. So I told you what we shouldn't learn from. That's what Heinrich wrote in 1931. So what should we learn from? We should learn from what happens and how it happens. We should look at what people actually do and try and learn from them. The other day, as we were walking down the street, we saw a guy going up on a ladder to take down one of the Christmas decorations a little bit early, I think. A very tall ladder, and there was another guy standing at the foot of the ladder holding a ladder, and there was another guy in a tree nearby with a rope, and the guy who climbed up the ladder had a rope in his hand, and I thought, that's not going to help very much if he falls, unless he's got very strong hands. But when I see that, I always say to myself, still, he's done it before, and he hasn't killed himself before. That's why he thinks it works. And that's why people do things. They've done it before and it worked. That's why they keep doing it. And we need to look at the situations they're in and try to understand why they're doing it and how they're doing it, and also why they come to this habit, and a sort of maybe even a social norm. This is what you do. You don't be a sissy. Don't tie it around your waist. Hold it in your hand. And so I think that's what we should learn from. We should learn from, I've used the phrase terms before, work as done, not from work as imagined. That's very important. See what actually happens and try and learn from that. And sometimes you'll be surprised at what happens. I think we can also look at ourselves and say, how often do we do things exactly the way they should be done? But because we know we're smart, and we know in this situation, this is a good way of doing it. So we know this works by experience, so that's what we do. And we know it's not dangerous, because we've never been hurt by it. I remember once in South Africa, you know, I had a bunch of work inspectors and talked to them. And I said to them, be honest. How many of you get into your car and start to drive and then put on the safety belt? And about half of them raised hands. Because you know, of course, you shouldn't do that. You should put on your belt before you start to drive, even the first meter. Because we know where the most accidents happen. They happen in the first bit of the movement. And many people sort of forget that because they've been doing it all their lives and they haven't had a crash yet. So it's perfectly safe to do it like that. And they save, you know, maybe half a second every time. And I don't know what that amounts to through a lifetime. But I know what could happen if something goes wrong. And it's more than half a second that you lose. So another thing that's important is in when we deal with safety and anything else that you say, I want to say the problems and solutions must match. So simple problems could possibly have simple solutions, but complex problems never have simple solutions. And discussing a complex problem as a simple problem by offering a simple solution, actually it doesn't make the problem any simpler. It only makes it almost certain that the solution is not going to work. So that's what you need to keep in mind. I know I'm making your life difficult, but that's why I'm here. And I think that was the end of it.
So we have time, I think, to take some questions. Diane, is that correct?
Yes, we do. Okay. Right. So I'm holding the mic. Who would like to ask a question? Hands up. Oh, is it that scary? Oh, thank you. Great. We have a volunteer. Come here.
Dr. Holnagel, big fan, like we all are. Could you comment on your thoughts about high reliability organizing and safety too? Is this part of the same? Are there similarities? Are they completely different? I'd like to hear your thoughts, sir.
He asked about the similarities between safety too and high reliability organizations.
Well, as far as I know, the idea of HROs came about after Charles Perrow's book, when people said that some organizations didn't have as many accidents as they thought they should have, according to Charles Perrow. So I think HRO is still focused on what goes wrong and noticing that. And I remember I have a friend in Norway who used to be a Navy pilot. And he told me one time that he flew on carriers, and he told me one time when he read about HRO, and they had one example was the carrier, and he said he couldn't understand because his comrades were crushing left and right. Why did they call it the high reliability organization? But the HRO was just, you know, clearing the deck before the planes took off and after they had landed, and had nothing to do with his colleagues dying when they were flying. So he was very confused about that. Now he's a professor at the business school in Bergen in Norway. I don't know if there's a moral in that. Probably not.
Eric, thank you. Again, I'll say what the last questioner said, and thank you for being here. I know I think it's your first big trip. And thanks. We're all really honored that you're here with us because you've influenced so much of how we think. So thank you. One thing that you said to me once that I still haven't reconciled that I wondered if you can comment on, and I hope I'm saying this right, but as I think you're a purist and I practice safety one and safety two together. And I wonder if you can comment on whether you think that works or if you think that to be really safe in the future, we need to come to a place where we're just focusing on safety too.
Thanks, Terry. I should admit I'm not too happy about the term safety one and safety two, but they seem to have caught people's attention. So I would rather say what we should be concerned about is to understand how work is done and make sure that we do everything we can so that it goes well. And I wouldn't call that safety too. So my concern is to make sure that things work and go well. And I think we all want that to happen. Did I answer your question?
Hi. Yesterday or Tuesday, you said something that piqued my interest. You said I had been thinking along these lines and testing it out. You said, I think we should not use the word safety, but we should switch to safely, an adverb. Could you expound more about that and where what that might take us? And also, will you write something about that that's not deep in a book?
I'm sorry. I have to admit I'm actually working on a book on mining safety with two other guys who knows about mining. I don't know anything about mining. I was professor at the School of Mining in France, but they don't have any mining there. That's probably why they appointed me. So I didn't need to know anything about mining, and I didn't learn anything about mining there. So we are writing this book, and we started out by calling it Managing Mining Safety. And after a while, we agreed we should call it Managing Mining Safely, because that's what it's about, managing mining. That's what mining companies do. They want to manage their mining so they get some revenue and some profit, and they want to do it safely so that people aren't killed on the ground, because mining can be very dangerous. I had an experience I went down in a coal mine in Australia some years ago, and I had a funny experience because, you know, they drive up down in little cars and they just take any car that's around and take that and use it. And we got into a car trying to go up again, and I tried to close the door, but it wouldn't close. And he said, well, this one doesn't work. Just hold tight to the door as you drive. And I felt extremely safe. But we did get up to the surface, as you can see.
We have time for one more question. Anybody, I'm sure there's a soul here who would like to hear, has a curiosity for Professor Hollnagel. Oh, John Wilkes. Hey, you want to talk about the God and the devil? Come on.
No, I'm actually going to ask a softball. What is your favorite book that you've written?
The one I think is my favorite is actually The Eto Principle. Mm.
Great. Why?
Because I thought it was a good idea.
Thank you. I don't think it's often we have the opportunity to thank a luminary like yourself. So thank you.
So there you go. That's going to pretty much sum it up for us. I hope you've learned some things on this one, because I think he had a lot of great information to share and some things to make you question things that you might be doing within your organization. Take a listen to that. Move forward. and see how you can make this world a little bit better than what it was the day before. That's always going to be the important part as we get to hang out. Anyways, I've been your safety manager and host, Jay Allen. And until next time, be safe.
The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the host and its guest and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the company. Examples of analysis discussed within this podcast are only examples. They should not be utilized in the real world as the only solution available, as they are based only on very limited and dated open source information. Assumptions made within this analysis are not reflective of the position of the company. No part of this podcast may be reproduced, stored in a retrieval system, or transmitted in any form or by any means, mechanical, electronic, recording, or otherwise, without prior written permission of the creator of the podcast, Jay Allen.
Have you ever wanted to start live streaming and were not sure how to do it? You can start live streaming up to 40 social media platforms all at one time, for as little as nada. It's going to cost you your time. That is what it's going to cost. You can pre-record, you can live stream, you can do a multitude of things. To find out more information, all you have to do is go to safetyfm.com/one. That's safetyfm.com, O-N-E.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together, because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.